Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Katie Weaver, Phil Dierking, and Alice Bryant. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Katie Weaver.
United Nations officials are calling on Algeria to stop the collective expulsions of thousands of migrants. The migrants are mainly from sub-Saharan Africa. The UN Human Rights Office condemned the expulsion activity as a violation of international human rights law. The UN office says Algerian officials carried out at least 6 mass expulsions of migrants in Oran, Douara, and Boufarik between March 8th and April 19th. Ravina Shamdasani is a spokesperson for the UN agency. She said that raids are reportedly carried out at building industry workplaces and in neighborhoods where migrants live. She said police also stop migrants in the street and detain them. Shamdasani told VOA that Algerian officials are taking the action without any examination or consideration of the individuals.
We are told that people are often just arrested and detained without even checking their documents. Of the 25 people that my colleague spoke to in Niger, only one said that she actually had her passport checked.
Shamdasani said many of the migrants were not permitted to get their belongings before they were expelled. She said some migrants were quickly sent to Niger. Others, she said, have been detained in reportedly inhumane conditions in military bases.
Nigerians are transferred by bus to Agadez in Niger, while the others are crammed into big trucks to be transferred to the Nigerian border, where they are then abandoned and left to walk for hours in the desert heat.
Shamdasani said that the UN office has heard statements suggesting that the migrants who remain in Algeria are very fearful. Shamdasani added that UN observation workers have expressed concern about these collective expulsions to Algerian officials. She would not discuss any answers they might have provided, but she said governments usually claim security issues as a reason for expulsions. Under international human rights law, migrants are not to be subjected to arbitrary arrest or detention. They also are not to be arbitrarily deprived of property or documents. The law says migrant returns should be carried out in safe conditions and with respect. I'm Katie Weaver.
The planned meeting between the leaders of the United States and North Korea may or may not happen. But a special coin has already been created to mark the event. The coin shows images of both U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. The two men are facing each other. Behind them are images of the American and North Korean flags. The top of the coin reads, "Peace Talks." The back shows an image of the White House. There are also images of Air Force One, the president's airplane, and the official presidential seal. The coin describes Kim as Supreme Leader, the name North Korea uses when identifying his position. The White House Communications Agency released the coin. The agency often creates special coins, called challenge coins, before major events or presidential visits. An American business manufactures the coins. They are presented to foreign visitors, diplomats, or members of the military. A number of special coins are also available for sale through the White House Gift Office. The agency ordered 250 of the Trump-Kim coins in preparation for the planned June 12th summit in Singapore. People are reacting to the coin on social media. Many are noting that the meeting might not even happen. North Korea last week threatened to reconsider the meeting. It released similar statements on Tuesday, the same day Trump said the summit may or may not work out for June 12th. He made the comment after his meeting at the White House with South Korean President Moon Jae-in. Others on social media question whether an American coin should honor the North Korean leader. United States Senator Chuck Schumer urged the White House to remove Kim from the coin, calling him a severe dictator. Schumer is the leading member of the Democratic Party in the Senate. He wrote on Twitter, "Challenge coins are a time-honored tradition and certainly appropriate in this situation, but Kim Jong-un's face has no place on this coin." Korea expert Robert E. Kelly is a professor at Busan University in South Korea. On Twitter, Kelly called the coin gross and un-American. Still others are discussing the unappealing image of Kim on the coin. They note that his face looks especially large. Raj Shah, a Trump administration official, said the White House did not have any input into the design and manufacture of the coin.
People learning a second language might have heard of the expression false friend. This term is used to describe words in different languages that look alike but have different meanings. Last month, we looked at examples of false friends in two languages, English and Spanish. Today, we will tell you about another language, French, that has a lot of false friends, the French words faux amis in English. You may be surprised to learn that English gets 30 to 45% of its words from French. The reason goes back to the year 1066, when Norman forces invaded what is now Britain. The Normans were from northern France and spoke French. During the Norman occupation, French became the language of England's rulers and wealthy class. This lasted for more than 300 years. Other people in England continued to speak English during this period. Over time, the two languages combined and shared words. Some researchers believe that about 10,000 French words eventually entered the English language. However, although English took many French words, their meanings have not always stayed the same. Sometimes the differences in meanings can be very important and lead to funny or strange situations if the words are used the wrong way. Take, for example, the French word collège. In English, college can often be used in place of the word university, or sometimes as a school within a university. However, in French, collège actually means middle school, or the level of schooling for students in grades 5 or 6 through 8.
There are many other similar words in the two languages with completely different meanings. In English, the word chat is a verb which means to talk casually. But in French, the word chat is the word for an animal, a cat. If an English speaker says someone is jolly, that means they are cheerful or friendly. But in French, joli means someone is good-looking or pleasant to look at. In any case, both are nice things to say to someone. Also in English, to go on a journey usually means a long trip of some kind. But in French, a journée is simply the word for a full day. So when you hear French speakers say bonne journée, they are telling you to have a good day, not a good trip. In English, the verb demand is something you say when you have a strong need for something. It is usually an impolite way to ask for something. However, in French, the word demander is a better way to ask for something. The speaker is showing more consideration of the other person's feelings. Native English speakers are often afraid to use demander when speaking French, as they worry that it may sound impolite. But worry not. Demander can also mean to wonder in French. If you put the word me in front of it. So, for example, the expression je me demande quand le film commence means I wonder when the movie begins.
Sometimes French and English words can have almost the same meaning, but with small differences. In English, if your friends will eventually arrive, that means they are not expected to arrive right now, but at some time in the future. In French, the word éventuellement means that they will possibly arrive, but their arrival is not guaranteed. However, if you wanted to say in French that your friend will not arrive anytime soon, but at some time in the future, you would use the word finalement. This can be confusing because the English word finally means that something will happen after a long period of waiting. It can also mean the last step in a process. The two words are similar, but with a very small difference in meaning.
Some false friends are important to know because you can accidentally say strange things if you use the words the wrong way. For example, in English, the word preservative is a chemical added to food to keep it fresh. But in French, a préservatif is a condom. As you can imagine, mixing up the meanings could lead to awkward exchanges or laughs for language learners. Another example is the word bra. In English, a bra is a piece of women's underwear. But in French, bras simply means an arm. The French verb exciter or the adjective exciter can cause problems for English speakers. Their meanings are the same as the English verb to excite and the adjective excited. However, one needs to be careful when using this word. While French speakers may use excité to say that someone becomes excited about something, often in French, excité is actually used to mean sexually excited. In some cases, it might be safer to think of different words to use if you don't want to risk creating an awkward situation.
Sometimes in French, the difference is not the definition of the word, but its use. The expression pas terrible in French means not terrible. In English, when one says something is not terrible, we mean that it is not too bad. However, in French, although pas terrible literally means not so bad, it can often mean that something is really bad. So, if you ask a friend if they like the food you prepared for them, and they say it's not terrible in English, that would mean it's not so bad. But if a French friend says that it was pas terrible, then you know you better improve your cooking skills. There are many more false friends in French, but these are some of the most common ones. However, if you speak French and are planning on traveling to an English-speaking country, it might be a good idea to study these before you go. I'm Phil Dierking.
And I'm Alice Bryant.
Welcome to the Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. A new leader stood before the American people on March 4, 1913. He was Woodrow Wilson, the 28th President of the United States. Wilson belonged to the Democratic Party. He was progressive in his belief that government should take an active part in efforts for social reforms. Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe begin the story of Wilson's presidency.
Woodrow Wilson had spent most of his life at Princeton University. First, he was a professor. Then, he was university president. Next, Wilson was elected governor of the state of New Jersey. His early success as governor made him a leading candidate for the Democratic presidential nomination in 1912. Wilson traveled widely around the country during the campaign. He made speeches to many groups. He tried to make himself and his ideas known to as many Americans as possible.
Wilson called his program the New Freedom. One of his campaign promises was to fight for better conditions for America's small business owners. Such proposals helped him win the Democratic nomination for president. Then he defeated President William Howard Taft and former President Theodore Roosevelt in the election. Woodrow Wilson, the former president of a university, had become the president of a nation. The largest crowd in Washington, D.C.'s history welcomed Wilson outside the Capitol building on the day of his inauguration. He called on the American people to join him in making the country a better place. "Our duty," Wilson said, "is to correct the evil without hurting the good. I call all honest men, all patriotic, all forward-looking men to my side.
Wilson wasted no time. He immediately called a special session of Congress to act on Democratic campaign promises to reduce import taxes or tariffs. Wilson felt strongly about the need to reform these taxes. He broke tradition by leaving the White House to appear before Congress in person to appeal for his tariff proposals. Many members of Congress opposed Wilson's plans, but the new president used the results of a Senate investigation to win the fight. The investigation showed that a number of senators owned companies that depended on high tariffs for their profits. The votes of these senators were influenced by their property holdings. Public knowledge of the situation forced many of them to give up their holdings and stop resisting tariff reform. Congress finally approved Wilson's proposals.
Lower tariffs reduced the amount of money taken in by the federal government. So the Senate also approved a tax on income or earnings. A constitutional amendment had been passed earlier to permit such a tax. President Wilson and the Democratic Party were pleased with the new tariff and income tax bills, but they were far from finished. Next, they turned their efforts to reform of the banking industry. For several years, many people had recognized the need for changes in the banking system. The old system of uncontrolled private banks had developed years earlier, before the United States became a major industrial nation. Many people agreed that a more modern system was needed, but they could not agree on details.
President Wilson said control of the nation's wealth was held by too few men. He noted a report that said just two men controlled 10% of the total wealth of the United States. Wilson said the nation needed a money supply that could be increased or reduced when necessary to correct economic conditions. He said a method was needed to let banks help each other during economic emergencies. And, he said, laws were needed to prevent a few wealthy men from using the economic resources of the country for their own purposes. Finally, Wilson said the control of this system of banking must be public, not private. It must belong to the government itself.
Wilson called his proposal for a central bank the Federal Reserve System. Under the plan, the nation would be divided into 12 areas. Each area would have its own Federal Reserve Bank. These area banks would not do business with the public. They would serve only as bankers' banks, and they would issue a new form of money supported by the federal government. Most important, the leaders of the new system would be chosen by the government, not by private business.
Bankers, business leaders, and their representatives in Congress sharply criticized President Wilson's proposals. They said government control of the banking system was socialism, not capitalism. But Wilson refused to change his proposals, and he helped to lead the fight to make them law. Finally, Congress agreed. It did not take long for bankers to discover that the new system was much better than the old one. Today, the Federal Reserve System is one of the most important institutions in the United States.
For Woodrow Wilson, the fight over the banking system was yet another political success. He had won major reforms in the nation's tariffs, taxes, and banking systems. Now, he told Congress, that new legislation was needed to control the power of monopolies and trusts. These were the giant companies and business alliances that controlled complete industries. Wilson proposed a new antitrust law to control the actions of large companies. His supporters in Congress wrote a bill that listed a number of business activities that no longer would be permitted. For example, no longer could a company set prices that would reduce competition or create a monopoly. No longer could corporations buy stocks of competing companies. No longer could they demand that a store refuse to sell competing products. The new bill also protected labor unions from being charged with antitrust violations. It gave unions more power to organize and protect workers.
At President Wilson's request, Congress also prepared a law that set up a government agency called the Federal Trade Commission. The commission was given the job of investigating wrongdoing in business. It had the power to force companies to obey the new antitrust laws and other rules. Both the antitrust law and the Federal Trade Commission helped protect small business owners from the power of business giants. Once again, the proposals caused fierce debate. But once again, Congress finally voted to give Wilson most of what he wanted.
The early months of Wilson's term were one of the most successful times in the history of any president. The new president had won the election by promising major reforms in the economic life of the country, and he had kept that promise. The reforms were not only a victory for Woodrow Wilson, they also changed the face of American business and economics for many years to come. The income tax, for example, grew to become the federal government's main source of money.
Woodrow Wilson had taught history in the days when he was a professor at Princeton University. He knew his actions as president could influence the country for a long time. But as a historian, he also knew his own term in the White House could be changed by unexpected events. That is just what happened. Wilson campaigned for president mainly on national issues, but he soon was forced to spend more and more time on international issues. His first big problem was across the United States southern border in Mexico.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.